You're traveling through another dimension. A dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition. And it lies between the pit of one's fears and the summit of one's knowledge. You are now traveling through a dimension of imagination. You just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of Anthology, presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. I'm your host, Matt Hurt, and ordinarily, Anthology is one man's examination of The Twilight Zone as a first-time viewer. Each podcast, I share my first impressions, analysis, and overall thoughts on Rod Serling's iconic series one episode at a time. However, as you guys know, I've been doing a bonus episode review series on the CBS All Access Season 2 of The Twilight Zone from Jordan Peele and Simon Kinberg and Monkey Paw Productions. And as you guys undoubtedly know, and I apologize profusely for this, I have been on a little bit of a hiatus. And yeah, it's just it kind of takes a lot to do these solo podcasts and everything. So I had every intention of resuming the review series for season two of the CBS All Access show, and my intention was to have it finished and good to go by the end of the year. And I was very delighted to have the opportunity to speak with Tanana Reeve Dhu and Stephen Barnes, the writers of the episode of Small Town. And so that's what this episode is. This episode is my interview with Tanana Reeve Dhu and Stephen Barnes. And my original intention was to release this interview kind of as a companion or connect it to my review of A Small Town, which is still forthcoming, but I don't know if you guys can tell by my voice. What happened was I had this interview with Tanana Reeve and Stephen, and within 2 hours of that interview completing, I started coughing and had a sore throat. And basically, I came down with COVID. And it has been a roller coaster, and it has been an infuriating roller coaster because I've been so careful and so mindful of everything in terms of wearing masks and social distancing and disinfecting everything, but I still caught it. So my original intention was to resume the episodes and release the rest of the season two of the CBS All Access show by the end of the year. But unfortunately, I don't think that's going to happen. But I'm going to release this special episode, which is my interview with the writers of A Small Town. And I'm so delighted that I got a chance to chat with them. And I'm so happy with the information and just the knowledge that they both shared with me about not only the experience of writing for The Twilight Zone, but their experience of working in that industry and the experience of just writing like a collaborative effort of writing. Like, I am such a dork for that kind of content, and this was just such a high for me. I was so delighted. They were so nice. So what I'm gonna do is release this interview for you guys to listen to, and then soon I'm going to finish my season two reviews of The Twilight Zone, the Monkey Paw Productions Twilight Zone, because I'm very anxious to get to those reviews and everything. I just haven't been able to within the last couple of weeks because, to be fair, or to be frank, this is the most I have been able to talk without going into hacking coughs and everything. Like, it was bad. My highest that my fever got was like 102, and I mean, just excruciating headaches and shortness of breath. It was terrible. So yeah, but I'm at the end of it now, or I'm on the rebound of that now, and I can actually talk into a microphone for an extended period of time without being doing that. But yeah, so I'm very fortunate that I was able to hopefully get clear of this thing. So per my doctor, I do have a couple, about a week and a half left of staying off of work. So maybe I'll fill up to recording some podcasts in that time. But in the meantime, I'm going to go ahead and release this episode, my interview with Tananarive Due and Stephen Barnes. Just super friendly, super, I really loved chatting with them. So I hope you guys enjoy this interview, and thank you so much for supporting me. And I do want to mention also that you can find more of Anthology as well as full episode archives at anthologypod.com. And if you want to contact me, you can use the Facebook page at facebook.com/anthologypod, or tweet me at @OVAnthologyPod, or send an email to matt@obsessiveviewer.com. And finally, if you want to support the show and get access to exclusive content, go to patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. And so I actually just recently revamped the reward tiers on Patreon for Obsessive Viewer podcasts. So if you pledge $1 or $2, you get access to a Patreon exclusive RSS feed. That is just a lot of me and the other co-hosts on Obsessive Viewer, just kind of chatting, kind of freeform discussions or chats and everything. It's a lot more laid back and fun. So check that out. But if you pledge at $5, you get access to that, as well as commentary tracks that I have been and will be recording. My goal is to release at least one a month next year. So hopefully that pans out. And then finally, the higher tier of that is $10, which gets you access to all that exclusive content, as well as, advanced and unreleased content. So, I actually have episodes of Anthology, the first two episodes of reviewing the third season of the original series Twilight Zone, up on that feed, because I recorded them and banked them with the anticipation of releasing them after I finished the new Twilight Zone series on the podcast. So those are there if you want to check that out now at the $10 level. But those will be released hopefully in January on the main feed here. So yeah, so without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and you know, play my interview with Tananarive Due and Stephen Barnes, the writers of A Small Town. And thank you once again to them for chatting with me. They were very, very gracious with their time, and I was delighted to be able to chat with them. And yeah, I hope you guys enjoyed the interview, and thank you guys so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.
Mr. Jason Grant. A man looking to make a big difference in a small town. But being the change you wish to see in the world is a lot more complicated when you've got that whole world in your hands. It's all a matter of perspective. Here, in the Twilight Zone.
All right, so hey guys, I'm here with Tananarive Due and Stephen Barnes, the writers of The Twilight Zone, Season 2, Episode 8, A Small Town, which is it is my favorite episode of the two seasons, and I'm just delighted to have both of you here on the podcast to kind of gush over it with you.
Sounds good.
We're delighted to be here to have you gush over it.
Yeah, gush over me all you want.
I feel like because of the pandemic, we didn't get as much
gushing.
Of a splash as you usually get when you have an episode of TV on television. So we're happy to have this conversation.
Absolutely. I mean, it was very meaningful to me because it was the first television I'd had produced, the live action television I had produced in almost 20 years.
Oh, wow. That's
so
incredible.
I'd had a severe career interruption because of family issues. Mm-hmm. And logically, I shouldn't have been able to work my way back into Hollywood. you know, ageism and other things just, you know, should have prevented me from doing that. But I'm a stubborn cuss, mm-hmm. and I've got a great partner.
Boy, is he a stubborn cuss. And boy, does he have a great partner.
That's great. And I mean, you do need that with something as competitive and as what I assume is hard to get into in the industry.
Insanely hard.
And it was your first time? Wasn't it your first time?
Yeah, it was also, well, I wrote for the Phil DeGuerre 1970s version of the Twilight, or was it 80s. Late the 80s version 80s. Of the Twilight Zone, too. And I grew up on the original one. I watched the original Twilight Zone in first run. So, you know, there was a dinosaur right next to me while I was watching there was unusually meaningful emotionally, completion of sort of a homecoming. So I was exceptionally happy to be able to do that and to work with Jordan Peele and Monkey Paw and Wynn Rosenfeld. Those guys, they're the best.
And for me, my very first television episode, we co-produced a short film in 2013. So I built my IMDb with that in like a short that we did with Blair Underwood. But in terms of someone hiring me to write a script for TV, very first time, could not be more excited that it was the Twilight Zone. Even though, like you, Matt, I did not really grow up watching it as a kid. I knew it existed. I knew it was a thing. I saw probably six of the original episodes, like the guy who broke his glasses. I wore glasses, so I remember that.
Burgess Meredith.
That one sticks out. But I was not a child of the Twilight Zone. So this, to me, was, well, just the thrill of having a produced television episode. I knew the reputation, obviously, of the show, but just so excited, like Steve said, to have the opportunity to work with Jordan Peele and Monkey Paw. That was the big win for me out of this.
Oh, absolutely. I can only imagine. And congratulations to both of you for it.
Thank you.
Yeah. So with that in mind, the kind of the mammoth undertaking it takes to do something of the stature of the Twilight Zone, did you have like any kind of not reservations, but were you conscious of like the property of the Twilight Zone when you were creating your episode?
You mean, well, there was a lot of emotional pressure for lots of different reasons. The stature of the Twilight Zone wasn't one of them. I mean, that was part of what made it fun. Mm-hmm. I wasn't thinking, oh my God, Rod Serling's ghost is watching. And I just, no, it was more like, oh my God, Jordan Peele is watching.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it was more immediate. So a creative artist has two different parts in their head, at least. Mm-hmm. One is the part that creates, and the other is the part that judges what you have created.
Okay.
And that part is always more sophisticated, and therefore it is always more Spartan, more critical. It will tell you about everything that can go wrong and all that you've done in the past that's gone wrong. And, you know, all of that, all the reasons that this can't possibly work, while the part of you that creates is just the kid that says, hey, let's put on a show. So, There were lots of voices in my head that were non-optimal, you know, and I just have to accept them. You know, they're part of the bestiary.
I want to go to the Wayback Machine and talk about how it all came about.
Oh,
that's okay.
That was
it was Twitter, how we met, Matt, actually. After I saw Get Out and fell in love with it, I proposed a course called The Sunken Place. I teach at UCLA.
Nice.
I was teaching Afrofuturism, which is basically Black speculative fiction. But, oh, Katie. But but I was tweeting about the fact that I was doing this class. A reporter for IO9, a freelancer named Evan Narcisse, who has since become kind of famous, actually, had a profile in the New York Times recently, reached out and said, I'd love to write a story about your Black horror class. The same day his story came out, Monkey Paw Productions followed me. I was already following Monkey Paw Productions, of course. So you know how it is on Twitter. They follow you. You can send a private message. So I sent a private message. Thanks so much for the follow. And, you know, I'm at the age now where I don't even care. If you don't ask, you don't get it. So I said it would be so great if Jordan Peele could visit my class. You know, whatever. Wow. Just give it a shot. Yeah. Jordan Peele himself, within 2 hours, got back in touch with me and said, ha ha, I could surprise them. And that's what happened. He came to the class. It was a little viral visit. One student posted like a 3-second clip. That was it. Wow. They were very protective of his privacy. 3-second clip. It went viral. He talked about us on the, not the Daily Show, but Stephen Colbert. And based out of that meeting, Steve and I were both there. We went to Monkey Paw to pitch.
Okay.
And at the time, Lovecraft Country was already put together. So I missed that train. And they thought the Twilight Zone would be a good fit for some of the stories we had pitched.
Yeah, we pitched a bunch of ideas, and they didn't make it into the first season.
Yeah, the first season we couldn't quite hammer it down. Gotcha.
And then in the second season came, Tananarive and I were actually up in Idlewild at a little writer's retreat that we did for each other, just like 3 days up in Idlewild in a cabin.
And we heard from Twilight. Let's back it up. They reached out to us.
It was on our way back from the Idlewild, wasn't it?
Oh, I thought we were already excited and talking about it on the way there, like literally on the phone with them while we were driving up there.
No, I don't remember whether or not we were doing that on the way there, but I do remember that they reached out to us on the way back. We were literally driving home from it, where we heard that, you know, that our pitch, or we were open to pitch, or that they wanted to work with us.
Yeah, they were like, we really feel bad. We couldn't figure anything out. First season, let's give it another try. So yeah,
you know, we're pitching a lot of different ideas, and you know, they come up with in-house ideas, and they will, you know, they'll say, well, what would you do with this idea? And then we do a take on it, and or we offer them an idea of our own, and they take a look at it. And somewhere in the midst of that exchange, we zeroed in on an idea that was originally called Tiny Cul-de-Sac.
Yes.
And there were several different takes on it, and it evolved into A Small Town.
Right. Nice. We thought A Small Town would be a better title for that. And
because it's a pun, you know, it's a small town, but it's also a town with small minds.
Right.
And it's also the model in the town.
Right.
So, you know, that three-way pun appealed to me. And so I said, yeah, that works pretty well.
And in case any of the actors are listening, I feel a personal responsibility to let them know that when we wrote that script, we said Desert Town. We did not say Winter Town. We did not have a drop of snow in our scripts. But unfortunately, the town they found, I think it's called I want to call it Ashcroft.
Maybe.
It's in British Columbia.
Right. I was thinking that about something in Arizona or New Mexico.
Right. But they shoot in, you know, in
and there were references that would have placed it there. And when they changed that location, we had to go in and tweak some dialogue and stuff like that.
Just tweak some stuff. But we were under very strict NDA, of course, not to talk about anything.
Right.
And we weren't really hearing many details about the schedule. They keep a pretty tight ship.
Now,
as you probably know.
We were given the opportunity to fly up and visit the set.
Oh,
but
wow.
Because we have a child in high school, only one of us could go.
Okay.
Because I have been on sets of shows I've been on the sets of most of the shows that I've written. But Tananarive had never had that experience. So it was like, okay, I stay home, you go.
And the way we even heard about the shoot underway is because I basically was doing just a random Google search for A Small Town in Twilight Zone in case someone like yourself had heard some kind of tidbit, you know, like someone who's a super fan might know something that I hadn't heard.
Sure.
And all these stories started popping up, including the CBC, which is like the national news outlet in Canada, about the shoot. The whole crew of Twilight Zone, 275 people, descended on this town. And it's just like the episode. The diner was bustling. I mean, it was their slow season. All these articles and interviews.
Everybody was so shocked. They brought in the giant spider. They had a real giant spider that was walking on the street. It was very well trained.
But I mean, here we were under NDA. And I can't even retweet this story because it's like CBC. Yes. It's like national news that they're shooting our episode right now. The mayor giving all kinds of, they did cameos. I mean, everybody, I'm telling you, there must have been like a dozen stories. Everyone who is an extra wrote a blog post or a story about the experience
of
the Twilight Zone shooting in their town.
And you just had to kind of take that all in and not spread it or anything, or you couldn't really comment on it.
No, it was because honestly, we had signed an NDA and it's the legal thing. But secondly, we have so much respect for Monkey Paw and for Jordan Peele. We would never, never, never do anything to go back on our word over something as silly as like publicity or trying to get the word out early. What was the point, you know?
Right.
You want to bend over backwards when it comes to stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
And, to be super careful.
Oh, yeah.
And, because you just never know.
Right.
Not having been through this process with them before, even though there were newspaper articles in Canada, us saying something about it publicly through social media might trip some lawyer someplace.
Yeah.
Who then says, these people are not nice to play with.
and then I don't get the invitation to the set visit, you know, which right. It was too difficult to pull it off. I really, really wanted to go to that town.
Or you don't get invited back to play again.
Right. But
that's really what I'm more concerned about. Mm-hmm. It's having the reputation as someone who's good to play with.
Yeah.
There are character actors in Hollywood who are not great actors, mm-hmm. but they're always working.
Oh, yeah.
And if you look into it, what you find out is these people are great. Mm-hmm. You know, they play cards with you and they bring donuts to the set. They always know their lines and they always hit their marks. They're never any trouble.
Professionals.
Mm-hmm. They're professionals. They're adults.
Nice.
Okay. In a business that often seems to be filled with children, broken
yeah.
children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Broken so the children. Idea is
good point.
To be the hardest working adult I can be. To be easy to play with, to be fun to play with. When someone gets off the phone with me, I want them to feel better about life than they felt when they got on the phone. I figure if I can be that guy and also a good writer, I'm going to have a career.
So, yeah, we turn in our drafts on time. If they said, you know, chop out 20 pages, we're like, okay, we'll chop out 20 pages. Right. If they say, oh, we have some budget issues, we need you to rework the third act, it's like, okay,
no problem.
The third act. So we're that person. And even when I was, I couldn't go to the small town because logistically it was just too difficult. Small planes, the hotels are filled. But they said you could watch the interiors. On the sound stages where they shoot in Vancouver, mm-hmm. which turned out to be just great. I got to meet Damon Wayans Jr., who stars in the episode, and the young man who played Emilio, whose name is slipping me, and also Alfonso Alvarez Barreda, who was the director, who was really, really sweet, and like me, was so super excited just to be doing it, you know? Mm-hmm. So we kind of related on that level. We were like, oh my God, we can't believe this.
just a comment about that. If you're around Hollywood, you'll notice that people use the phrase, we're super excited to, you know, to do this, to meet you, to read. Like, and it can feel, you know, the old thing used to be, oh, we loved your work. We love you. We're big fans.
We're the biggest fan.
And it sounds phony.
It is phony.
Except that it's not exactly. It really isn't. Because enthusiasm, emotion is the fuel that gets the rocket going. When you lose that enthusiasm, you shouldn't be working in a dream factory anymore. So the people who are there, they will say things like that. And it's partially because it's true and partially because they want to gin up their enthusiasm so that they'll have the fuel necessary to power the project. So, you know, I make fun of it, but I also understand it's necessary.
But I mean, being there on set, you know, I guess I have to say I fell in love with the model. Mm-hmm. That's the thing I remember. Oop. Oh, you still there? The model was, as you see in the episode, because it's beautifully shot, so intricate,
yes, the
and
detail.
Detailed. Are you frozen?
So good.
Is it me?
No, you're
okay.
Frozen.
So it was so intricate and detailed. I was taking all these pictures of it, and I think people were very nervous that I was taking pictures because I expected them to show up on Instagram, mm-hmm. but they have not. I was literally almost like a kid in a candy store bouncing around that set. Just, you know, they've had a long slog of a shoot. They were in this freezing cold town. Now they're just wrapping up the interiors and I'm showing up fresh and bouncy. It's like, oh my God, this is fun. So I have a feeling maybe I was a slight irritant. No one said it. No one even behaved like I was, but I kind of felt like maybe I was.
Yeah, the writers are not the heavy hitters on set. You know, it's like this term, but you hear about the Polish actress who screwed the writer. You know?
but I was very impressed. They were able to pull out one of those folding chairs with the word writer on it for me to sit
nice.
In. So that was exciting. Yeah.
It's nice. It's a real privilege. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I hope you can pick up on here is that the role of a writer in Hollywood is not the same as the role of the writer in New York in publishing. That a writer, your script is not a piece of literature. Mm-hmm. It's not a story. It's the blueprint for a story.
Yeah.
It's the schematic mm-hmm. for a story. And all these artists, you know, the production people, the director, the actors, all those people have to come in and take your schematic and turn it into something real.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And if you understand that, then you can suspend some of your ego. You're part of a team. Mm-hmm. You're here to help the team pull the plow. No one dog gets that sled across Alaska. Mm-hmm. You're working together. Yep. It's an honor. I mean, it really is. And it's very difficult to get yourself into the position to have this opportunity. It's much easier to sell a short story or a book. Far, far, far easier. Hollywood is, it's impossible to get in, and people get in every day. Mm-hmm. So everyone's story about how they got into Hollywood is going to be a little bit different. Right. So you study that.
Yeah, it can't always be, I invited Jordan Peele and he came to my class.
Yeah, it's not likely to happen again.
You know, and it's always stuff like that. It's like, seems like really random things. But
well, she's good at these random things. I don't understand. She really does have a touch of magic about how, you know, she landed a whale with a spider web is the way I put it.
Well, I've been publishing horror, and specifically black horror, since 1995. Mm-hmm. And it was a tough road in terms mm-hmm. of adaptation and getting diverse casting, for mm-hmm. example. So Jordan Peele was a kindred spirit in my mind from the minute yeah. he appeared on the scene. Mm-hmm. I love what he's been doing in both the film and the TV space.
Oh, me too.
And I have a special regard for the way they really adhered to the casting in the way we wrote it. Now, there were things that were changed. I knew as soon as I got there on set and I was hearing the scene, it's like, wait a minute, I don't remember those lines. So I was like, let me see the script. So there were some changes in the script, but the things that they really held, I mean, the major pieces were still there. Like, for example, we had mentioned a wedding ring, but we didn't have like a big wedding ring at the end. That was, okay. I think, somebody's brilliant idea. I like it. But we wrote the ethnicities of the characters, and Steve, you can contrast the way it used to be. We wrote Damon Wayans' character as black, that the pastor, Nikki, was black, that her husband was Filipino. They actually hired a Filipino actor to play her husband. I looked him up on IMDb. He was actually Filipino. The Latino family, all of that was on the script level. And they really just adhered to all of it.
See, in contrast to that, the first story I wrote for the original Twilight Zone was called Teacher's Aid, starred of Adrienne Barbeau, who I'd worked with on Maude at CBS when I was a tour guide, and she played Maude's daughter.
Oh, wow.
It's going back.
Yeah, seriously. I have a story about a Christmas party that I probably will not tell. There was... she was an inner city remedial English teacher who gets possessed by a demon that helps her deal with the gang that kind of plagues the school. And the gang was very clearly written black and they cast it white. I did another story for The Outer Limits called The Heist, I think it was, about a street gang that hijacks a military armored convoy that they think is filled with Stinger missiles, and it's actually pieces of the Roswell UFO crash, and there's something alive in there. And they said they could not have this be a black street gang because there weren't enough black people in British Columbia, and they would have to import Negroes to Canada.
Oh, wow.
It was just, and I saw that, and it was like, oh, it's like that. That's what they're going to do.
And I thought because they were shooting in Canada again, that they would have a difficult time, but whether it was camera angles or whatever it is, they managed to create this very diverse small town, which one article pointed out is, where do we see that in television and cinema? This small town that is actually also multi-ethnic.
Mm-hmm. And that is something that stands out in the episode in a really great way. It's something that it also, like, the kind of sense of community comes through really clearly. And kind of especially since it aired in June, like when we're in the middle of a pandemic and everything, it kind of had this interesting resonance for its airing and stuff. So, but yeah, that kind of sense of diverse community kind of coming together is really strong in the finished product.
Excellent.
Yeah. Well, you may have had some questions, Matt.
Okay. Yeah.
we just got a little bit of
that. Oh, no, this is great. I appreciate it. I do want to ask, how was what's the process? I mean, you guys have worked together, obviously, for a long time, I'm sure. Like, what's the process of actually, like, creating the script and everything? And was this one of the in-house pitches that they had, or was this something that you guys pitched and
when we say an in-house pitch, they might have come to us with a log line.
Yeah, like a one-sentence premise.
Yeah, and then we fleshed it out.
What would we do with that?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Who would be living this story? What would the beats of the story be?
So, you know, being married and knowing that we wanted to write together, I set up a rule from the very beginning that the relationship itself could never be on the line. that the writing and the relationship had to be in two different rooms.
Okay.
Because if an individual artist will fight with themselves about images and thematics and stuff like this, then if people are in a collaboration, they have to be able to fight. Mm-hmm. They're going to have, you know, passionate, deeply held points of view, even when she's wrong. And if we're
and
not,
especially when he's wrong,
and if we're not free to tear each other a new one, then we're not going to get to the good ideas.
Oh, yeah.
So it's going to get intense at times. Mm-hmm. And the only way to do that so that there's no fear, if this argument goes south, it might damage our love. It might damage really. There can be no abandonment issues. Yeah. There can be no sense. No, there's no side door. There's no back door. Neither of us is looking for an exit. This is it. Our marriage is it. We're committed to that.
What? So can I add something?
Yeah.
When we went to meet in person, and we did meet in person with Jordan Peele and Wynn Rosenfeld, we brought 5 takes. A combination of our takes on a couple of in-house ideas and a few original ideas. There were some that I had liked more and some that Steve had liked more.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So A Small Town turned out to be one of Steve's.
Okay.
That meant that he took lead on it.
Yeah. So that's the other thing. Whoever, sometimes you'll see something that we write and her name goes first. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's my name goes first. That tells you who it is that wrote the first draft.
Unless it's just alphabetical, which is kind of confusing because sometimes we're almost close to even.
No, we've never done alphabetical.
My Kitchers is almost close
to even. No. I did the first draft on that.
I know.
That's why my name goes first.
Yeah. Anyway, some of them will be alphabetical in the future.
I don't think so. I think because, you see, here's the thing. That in working with Larry Niven, which was my education for science fiction, one of the things he taught me is that somebody's got to have the kill switch. Mm-hmm. Somebody has to be in charge. Now, you can flip a coin, but somebody has to be the one to ultimately say yes or no. Otherwise, you can get to the point where you can't make a decision and the project dies.
Oh, yeah.
So that will never happen if one person gets to say, okay, this is how we're going to do it. You know, you can listen to the arguments, you can do this. And so sometimes she's the one with the kill switch. Other times I'm the one with the kill switch. But I don't think it's ever going to come down to 50-50.
All right. Well, so in this particular case, and this is the model for how we work on everything, and one of the reasons we're able to work so well and so quickly, is that we outline. You know, it happens that in television you get paid for that outline. But whether or not we were paid for it, we can't write a script unless we have a detailed treatment / outline that we have both agreed upon. Now,
because she has her way of dealing with the story. I have mine. So if we don't have an outline and she goes off and writes the first draft, and look at this, like, you went someplace. I can't write this.
Yeah.
Right. So we agree on the broad strokes, or actually we agree on quite a bit. Like, it's all laid out in the outline stage.
Yeah.
And then the person who is taking lead writes the first draft. And we don't like sit side by side or anything like that, but we do use a computer program called Writer Duet, which is free, by the way, writers. I like it just for screenwriting, even if it's not a collaboration.
But it's perfect for collaborating.
You can write on it simultaneously.
That's right. Wow. It's really wonderful, like a Google Doc, and, you know, only with formatting.
And new text pops up in red, so I can watch what he's writing while he's writing it, and vice versa.
So, and I can write 5 pages a day. Mm-hmm. It takes me about 40 minutes. If I know where I'm going and I know what's going on, all I do is kind of, you know, go into alpha state, imagine the scene, and I type what I see.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so it's garbage. You know, it's full of mistypings. And if it's text, then, you know, the syntax is off and the grammar is off. Like, I don't worry about any of that. It's just get it out of my head and onto the page. Once it's on the page, then maybe tomorrow or the day after or next week, I'll go back and work on it. But it's like I separate out the flow state from the editor state. That's all that writer's block is, is a confusion of flow state and editor state. If you separate the two of them out so that you're just flowing, you don't worry about the quality of it. You can write all day long. It's garbage. But if you let yourself spew garbage and then you understand, well, what is it that produces the flow? Well, it's the quality of your input. It is the degree, in other words, you consciously work on improving your flow. It's a little bit like martial arts. You practice things perfectly And then one day you're going to turn around and there's a fist heading at your face and you respond in some way. That's the garbage. And you the work that you did in the school will make your garbage better and better and better. And that's true with your writing too, that you're constantly refining, you're constantly studying, you're looking at it, you're watching the best movies you can, you're reading the best books you can, and you trust that your subconscious mind, that the unconscious competence part of you is going to slowly get better and better and better. So the part of you that the editor part is always going to look at the garbage that's flowing out and it's going to be saying, oh man, you know, that's crap. But my philosophy is that you keep digging through that pile of horse manure because you know there's a pony in there somewhere.
So yeah, and going back and forth, polishing as we go, discussing ideas. Then we come up with visual symbols to sort of show more about the character. And then you end up with a rough draft, and then they say, or a first draft, and they say, oh yeah, we need like 20 pages cut out of this or whatever. We had more about the mayor and his family in our original draft. And one of the changes that must have happened after our last draft that I really like actually is that more of the blame for what was going wrong was shifted to the mayor. In our draft, the mayor had been a little more successful in riling the townspeople up against the boy. The child, so that they work smaller, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. The town itself was a little bit smaller. And in this version, they refined that so that the mayor was almost immediately mostly to blame. That his efforts were unsuccessful to try to scapegoat the boy.
Right.
It's a softer version of the story, but seeing it on screen, I think it works very well, because one of the things you don't want is to be too on the nose. Mm-hmm.
And my impression is that what they never know exactly what they want from you. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't want you to give them back the suggestions they gave you. They want you to give them what they would do if they had all the time in the world.
Oh, okay.
They don't. Okay. Right. So understanding that, reading between the lines, trying to create what they would do if they had the time and the background to do it. And then the understanding that once you finish it, then they're going to take it in-house.
Yeah.
And they're going to do what they need to do, you know, based upon their
budget,
aesthetic,
based
the budget,
on whatever.
The other scripts that they've got in, mm-hmm. what's happening, the arc of emotional flow through an entire season. You know, you don't know what that is. You're not sitting in the room
right.
with them. So the idea of being able to work with them in that sense was a real honor that they would mm-hmm. trust us with. How much budget was the budget on that?
It's not public.
It's not public?
No.
Okay. I assumed you could look that up.
No,
you
know. But it's a very high budget show, okay. Which is one of the reasons they decided to do it. Mm-hmm. And the thing I learned is that a whisper is a shout. Mm-hmm. In television. I learned that from watching Damon Wayans do his lines on camera, which seemed to me as an observer like very understated delivery. Like, and when you see it on screen, there's so much more nuance than you can. It's not a stage play. It's not like you're sitting in the audience and you can see the nuance. It's camera mm-hmm. acting. It's different. Yeah. And so that was a huge lesson. And the second huge lesson was in terms of the theme, because, you know, Twilight Zone has social justice themes. That was mm-hmm. kind of what hung us up first season, is they couldn't quite figure out the social justice angle on our story.
Okay.
That was one of the big hangups. So this one, you know, there were some people who thought, well, you guys, is the mayor supposed to be Trump? It wasn't really literally supposed to be that. But sure. Of course, you have a town with a bad leader who was basically riling up the town to try to turn on some of the citizens of color. I could see where there yep. would be some parallels there.
Oh, absolutely.
But in softening it and making the town not respond to it as strongly, having their ire turn more toward the mayor and less against this boy, supporting the family, you still get your message across. He's still the only little Latino boy in this town. Mm-hmm. And it's terrible that the mayor is accusing him of. You get all that punch, you know, but without the town being dragged into it, I thought it was a more pleasant viewing experience and felt less on the nose than it would have felt if the whole town had turned on this kid.
Yeah, I wouldn't have wanted to do something that was specifically political. I'm not specifically political. I consider myself philosophical mm-hmm. about things.
I wouldn't have minded, but whatever.
But you say tomato. No, I say rutabaga. So it's, like I said, it's threading a needle. One of the ways I used to look at writing in Hollywood is that you have a bunch of different moving needles, mm-hmm. and you have to put a thread through all the eyes. There are producers and actors and directors and story editors and showrunners and all these different people, all of whom have to say yes, all of whom have creativity, all of whom are intelligent people with sensitivity. And if you can figure out how to stay loose enough to listen to everything they're saying and find a way to create something where the core of what you're doing is strong enough that even after you change it, it still feels like yours, so that you look at it on the screen and you say, well, they're all the, you can, there are people who focus on the changes and think, oh God, that's not mine. They'll take their name off and they, right. Or you can look at it and say, there's enough of what is there. I did something here that was good for these other good, smart, creative, intelligent people to be able to express themselves.
Yeah.
You see 200, almost 300 people involved in this. These are people who are paying bills, putting their kids through college, building their own careers and portfolios. What you create has to work for all of them. And if you can do that and still have that sense of individual pride, that little kid inside you saying, I did that, then you can work in this industry.
And the idea that we said it was a small town, so they found a small town. And then because of the impact of that, they had a booming winter season that they were not used to having. We gave people jobs, you know, we filled up hotel rooms. That was such a humbling experience.
Yeah. Oh, I can imagine. And that location that they found is just gorgeous. Like that,
it is.
It really pops on screen.
Well, this is a good thing.
I understand it has been discovered by Hollywood and is going to be busy. But we were some of the first to get it shot there. I just want to make sure. Is it British Columbia? I want to make sure.
Yeah, it's British Columbia.
Ashcroft, is it?
That sounds as possible.
Okay. Anyway, it's a tiny little the way we described it in the script, and I think this was your language, Steve, you – in order to call it a one-horse town, first you would have to find the horse.
You'd have to lend it a horse.
Lend it a horse, yeah.
That's one of the first lines of the script.
And they were like, okay, bet. And that's what they did.
Oh, that's fantastic. I wanted to ask you about specifically the tone of the episode. I have a couple of different podcasts. One is a Stephen King podcast, and this episode feels very much like in the same vein as like a Stephen King story. And I know
that's high praise.
No, I love it.
He is the master.
Well, he's the king of small town settings, isn't he?
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, yeah.
More than that, to me, he's brilliant at taking values. And he's brilliant at understanding what you love, and then attacking it in some way, and then showing how people either fail their moral test or come together and rise. And this is why he was the great 20th century storyteller, as far as I'm concerned, and is still a vital force.
Yeah,
the man is he's an amazing.
Yeah,
he's an awesome. So, have you had a chance to talk to him?
Oh no! That would be a dream come true. Oh yeah, I haven't. But he is.
Well, I hope you get that chance because he's. I had the honor of meeting him a few times. It's an honor, actually had the opportunity.
My second book, actually.
Yeah. He's priceless.
Yeah. So we interrupted you.
He will not
sorry.
Disappoint.
Oh, no, you said fine. Stephen King, and that is the word that makes us.
Oh, absolutely.
Talk a lot, but in terms of the tone,
yeah.
There's also, there's that. There's that sort of Stephen King like setting and sort of the human frailties that are fueling, say, the supernatural element of this story. But it's also decidedly, I would think, more lighthearted than most Stephen King, intentionally so.
True.
Well, he can be pretty lighthearted in his short stories.
Okay.
Yeah, I've seen some very funny Stephen King, but more people die.
Yeah. This was more family friendly, yes, there's a giant spider, but this spider doesn't really hurt anybody. So that kind of thing. It was Stephen King without claws and teeth, I would say.
That's one thing to take note of that, that if we know that we don't want anybody to die, then how do you create tension? You create tension because you know it's part of a series, and then in other episodes of that series, people did die.
Yeah.
So the audience does not know what's about to happen. So that's one of the things that we constantly remind ourselves of. You know, people don't know what's about to happen here. So right. even though we know that we're not going to kill more than a couple of people, mm-hmm. as far as they're concerned, we're going to kill off everybody.
Right.
So we've got tension because of the expectations of the genre mm-hmm. or the series or other films that are similar to this or other things that you and I have written. You don't always have to put people through the meat grinder.
But also, and we named the character Jason after our son, Jason.
Oh, that's nice.
The real horror is, what is this power going to do to him?
Right.
What is this going to do to his heart when he has the ability to hurt other people? And by extension, the audience members, we get to ask ourselves, what would we do if we had this power?
Yeah, you see, I don't believe that power corrupts. I believe that, you know, in absolute power corrupts absolutely. I believe that that was some guy's opinion, and that they're a lot like sunlight or rain, that whatever is in your flower bed will grow, weeds or roses. And so it is a test of character. That's my position on it. So when I'm writing something, I think you were a little bit more in the power corrupts category, weren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So see,
because I think people have to sort of, but when you don't have the power, you really don't know who you're going to be.
That's true.
Yeah. When
that's
you're talking true. About a revelation of character.
But what I'm saying is that what you just noticed there, that conversation, that gives you thesis and antithesis. Mm-hmm. That two things that you need in a story anyway, that you can literally go into it and say, well, I think that power is neutral. You think the power is negative unless you mitigate against it. Those are two different positions on power, which then get to act out through different characters in the story. You now have the oppositional force that you need to drive drama.
Yeah, the pastor would have done very different things with that model.
That's right.
The mayor, obviously, would have done very different things with that model.
So I'm saying that to say that Tanana Reeve and I don't have to agree, that we can actually put our disagreement into the story itself. It's part of what powers it, because otherwise I'd have to take both positions myself. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're doing a story on child abuse, you know, once you're abused, you'll never heal. The other point of view is, no, child abuse can be overcome with love. Okay. And so those two positions, thesis and antithesis, work together to ultimately create synthesis, where you say, well, it can create, you might even have a character and then you have a sub character that each of which is exemplifying a different point of view in what it is that you're doing thematically. So all of that stuff, you know, the primary thing is, are you telling a good story?
Yeah.
All the stuff about thesis and antithesis and, you know, and synthesis and thematics.
Are these people behaving in ways that are consistent with your understanding of human psychology and human behavior?
That's right.
Yeah.
And ultimately, it's just, you know, people don't want to be taught. They want to be entertained.
Exactly.
So, you know, one of my mentors told me that your book has got to have at least as much, be at least as entertaining as a six pack of beer, because they cost the same thing.
Oh, that's great. Let's see. Okay, I think I might be running out of time here.
Yes, I think you are.
We talked your ear off.
Oh, no, this was great. I really appreciate you guys taking the time to chat with me. And once again, congratulations on the episode and everything.
Thank you so much. It's very meaningful.
Yeah. So glad you like it.
I cannot.
Props to the director for the visual sense he brought, because we had the mural and all that in the script, but he brought it to life.
Absolutely.
Using Mexican, his own background.
See yourself as part of a team, and the team will have people on it who are smarter than you and will do things. And it's all you want to do is you want to give them your best, you know, give them your best, and take the football and run, you know. And then if you can sit back and look what they did with it, then, like I said, you can survive in this business and feel happy and feel like you've done something with your life.
Oh, absolutely. That's a great sentiment. And the collaboration on the episode came through, like it seems like having had this conversation with you guys, the collaborative effort just created just such a strong episode that I loved dearly. So I definitely appreciate
Wonderful.
You guys doing that.
I'm delighted.
So glad you liked it.
Yeah. Afrofuturism webinar.com.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I was going to ask, do you want to just tell people where they can find you online?
Yeah. If you like hearing our voices and hearing us talk about speculative arts, We teach a course online, digital download, on Afrofuturism, basically Black speculative fiction and the history of it, at www.afrofuturismwebinar.com.
And on Black horror, it would be sunkenplaceclass.com. Nice. And you
Jordan
know,
Peele actually, before all this, Skyped in yeah, to that class. So
Tony Todd is on it. It's yeah. wonderful. We got very lucky. We know so many wonderful people in the industry right now, and it's a blessing. I do not for a moment, like I said, I wasn't supposed to be able to get back in. Mm-hmm. So I am treasuring every moment of this new cycle of
yeah, life. I'm on my fourth career. I wasn't supposed to get in at all.
Well, okay. I'm really looking forward to what you guys do next, and I can't wait to see what you guys do.
We'll talk
so
again.
You take care. Absolutely. When the podcast is out.
Oh, all I right. definitely will. Thank you.
And
guys.
Send us the link so we can publicize it.
Oh, all right. Absolutely. All right.
Okay, bye-bye.
We can never calculate what change our actions will bring into the world, despite our best intentions, and whether they will be for good or ill. Yet without action, the stars themselves go cold. Jason Grant wanted to change the world for the better, but the power to do so got the best of him until he lost it all. But today, perhaps losing it all, both for Mr. Grant and for the town of Littleton, was the beginning of something new. Lonely hands find each other in the shadows, both in our imperfect world and in the Twilight Zone.
And now, here's a short clip from our Patreon-exclusive RSS feed. To hear the full clip and more exclusive Patreon content, go to patreon.com/obsessiveviewer and become a patron at the minimum rate of $1 per month. Thank you and enjoy. Like, one of the things that I really love about TV in a weird way is, like, looking at the episode titles. Because sometimes I think they can be really clever and everything.
Yeah.
Like, there are a bunch of episodes of The Office that have, like, a double meaning. Like, the injury is both Michael's foot injury and Dwight's concussion.
Yeah,
and the
right.
secret is Jim's crush on Pam and Oscar's homosexuality.
Right.
And so, like, they do, like, fun stuff like that. But I will say that the series finale of Lost was one of those times where I was like, okay, I shouldn't like this, but I do. Do you remember what the title of the series finale was?
I don't.
It was The End. Which I thought that was really good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And speaking of Lost, oh, God, I love Lost so much.
It's been a long time since I've watched it.
You know, it's me too. And I've recently gotten back into watching a little bit of it at a time because Kirsten and I are doing The Lost Point on
right.
Obsessive Viewer.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend of mine posted on Facebook, like, what are scenes from movies that immediately make you just tear up and cry? And I was like, well, and like, in my head, I had a few, and I'll ask you that question, then we can go into the episode.
Okay.
But, I had a few keyed up and I was like, there's a common thread with these. So I was like, okay, well, apparently the composer, Michael Giacchino, has a direct link into my soul because, the scene in Up, not that one, at the end of Up, not the beginning of Up, like the beginning of Up is tragic and sad and makes me cry too and everything, but I will be reduced into a blubbering mess at the end of the movie where, spoiler alert, he goes through the scrapbook and, like, he sees that, like, I'm getting chills just thinking about it.
Anthology is edited and produced by Matt Hurt and presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. For a full archive of our episodes, go to anthologypod.com/archive. You can also like the Facebook page at facebook.com/anthologypod and follow the show on Twitter at @OVAnthologyPod. If you enjoy the show, please take a couple minutes to leave us a rating and a quick review on Apple Podcasts. This is the easiest way to support what we do, and all it costs is a little bit of your time. If you'd like to donate to the podcast, you can make a PayPal donation at anthologypod.com/donate, or support us on Patreon for recurring donations and access to commentary tracks and B-roll audio recorded exclusively for patrons at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. Every donation goes toward paying the fees to keep the podcast running and is greatly appreciated. Official Anthology merch, including shirts, mugs, phone cases, and more, can be found in the Obsessive Viewers TeePublic store. You can find a link to the store in the show notes of this episode and at anthologypod.com/donate. or you can simply search for Obsessive Viewer at tpublic.com. For information about the Obsessive Viewer's annual live event showcasing short horror films from local filmmakers, check out shocktoberinirvington.com. And for an archive of all our events, as well as news about potential future events, head over to obsessiveviewer.com/live. For more podcast content, you can find our flagship movie and TV review and discussion show, The Obsessive Viewer Podcast, at obsessiveviewer.com and on Twitter at obsessiveviewer. You can also find Tower Junkies, a podcast where Matt and co-host Tiny share their love of all things Stephen King and his magnum opus, The Dark Tower series, over at towerjunkiespod.com and at towerjunkiespod on Twitter. And finally, check out The Secular Perspective, Tiny's side project podcast, which tackles current events and life's big questions from the perspective of secular hosts Chad and Amanda at thesecularperspective.com. Bumper music for this podcast comes courtesy of As Good As It Gets, which can be found at facebook.com/asgoodasitgetsband. You can also find As Good As It Gets music on Spotify, Google Play, and iTunes. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Kitty!